Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Want to remind everybody, this next weekend, starting Friday, Rebel Capitalists Live in Houston, January 7th through the 9th. It is here, and I'm extremely excited to see people like Ron Paul and Chris Cole, Lynette Zhang, Richard Werner, Lynn Alden, Robert Kiyosaki, just to name a few. So if you guys have not gotten your tickets, make sure you head over to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can check out the list of speakers and grab your tickets. It starts this next Friday. Registration at noon in Houston. Cannot wait. We'll see you guys there. So let's dive into your questions. See what we got for this evening. Happy New Year, by the way. Do I think Lacey Hunt puts too much faith in legal tender switch not getting flipped? He seems to trust congressional process. Yeah, he's got a lot more faith in it than I do. I don't know how he holds that after what they did with the Federal Reserve Act in March 2020. I don't know how you could have faith that they'll abide by any law, not just the Fed, but the government. I mean, the Constitution, they completely ignore it. The Federal Reserve Act, they completely ignore it. So, I mean, that's really the difference between Lacey Hunt and like a Luke Groman, is they just see the odds of that happening a little bit different. Dr. Lacey Hunt might think that's a low probability outcome, where Luke Groman probably thinks it's a high probability outcome. I would be on the side of high probability outcome. It's all depending on the stock market. If the stock market goes down, then high probability outcome. If the stock market does not go down in nominal terms, unless we have a massive crack up boom where inflation is outpacing. But even then, I don't know that would prompt them to do it right away. The thing that would prompt them to do it the fastest is if the stock market goes down in an unorderly fashion by 20-30%, something like that. Is there a trade you benefit from if price controls are implemented? I mean, commodity producers, because most likely they'd go down. I'd have to see what commodity producers did back in the 70s and 71. But assuming there's price controls, my guess that probably makes producers go down, because the market is saying, okay, they're not going to be able to lift their prices, but their costs are going to increase. It's going to squeeze their margins. What I would do there is I would just look at the best balance sheets for the commodity producers and buy those when they got really, really cheap, kind of once all that news has been absorbed by the market and all of the downside risk has been absorbed into the price. Then I would consider buying, because what you'll see is when price controls are lifted, assuming they eventually are, commodity prices just go parabolic, because that's where they need to be. And that's what brings more supply. And that's what brings us to an equilibrium point. So I'd have to see what happened back in the 1970s. My guess is that's what happened, but I don't know for sure, because I haven't specifically looked at a chart. But that would be my first thought for a trade or an investment based around price controls. I mean, the bottom line is you're going to reduce supply, you're going to reduce quality. So, I mean, really what we see in the ESG space is price controls. I shouldn't say it's price controls, but it has the same effect, because why do price controls reduce quality or supply? Because there's no capital investment, because they know they can't make a profit, or there's a lot less capital investment. It's the same thing with ESG, although it's not about profit, it's just about virtue signaling. So, but the net effect is still the same. There is no capital investment, therefore the supply decreases or the quality decreases. So what has happened as a result of the ESG movement and reducing capital into natural gas and oil and coal. Well, you guys have seen what's happened to the prices of those commodities in the last year, year and a half. They've gone straight up. So my guess is the same would happen eventually with price controls. If long vol is the only truly non-correlated portion of a Dragon portfolio, what if the Fed, gold as well. What if the Fed manipulates vol? According to Joseph Wang, they can't buy options, but QE can suppress volatility. Yeah, it can suppress volatility, but it can't kill it. You can't destroy it. It only shows up in some other area, comes out a different crack. Or if you suppress it, when it does come out, it's just that much bigger. When it's it comes out into the market, it's that much more of an extreme event. So yeah, they can suppress it, but they can't destroy it. And as far as you got to throw gold in there as well. But also, I would say commodity trend is not really correlated, because commodity trend, Joel, you're following commodity prices, whether they're going up or down. So I'm not sure if it's the only truly non-correlated portion. So I get it. The commodities are going to be correlated in a way, but you're playing both sides of the commodity, because you're playing it on the way down and playing it on the way up. So I would see that as not really correlated. As an example, not correlated to stocks, you know, because stocks could be going one way, and you could still be, even if you're not long, or even if you're not short, you could be making money on the commodity trade. So, but as far as the Fed really being able to suppress volatility, they did QE, they tried to suppress volatility, and look at what happened in 2020. Did we see volatility in March? A lot, right? So I don't know if they can completely control volatility or suppress it. It's only a matter of time. And you'll please note that in March 2020, it wasn't really the Fed that stopped the volatility. It was the government coming out with the CARES Act. That's, in my opinion, what stopped the volatility. See, do you have a black swan event for 2020? Inflation. If consumer price inflation continues to go up, they got big problems, my friend. They got big, big problems. Because everything they've done has been in an environment of disinflation. So you create an environment of inflation and progressively higher inflation, and that puts the kibosh on QE, government spending. And then how on earth do you prop up the markets then? So, yeah, that's the black swan event I see. But I don't know if it's that much of a black swan, because I think it's just, I think quite a few people are, at least in my space, a lot of people are seeing that the Fed raises rates, stock market crashes, then they're backed up into a corner where they really can't do anything, because if inflation is still running hot, then they can't just support asset prices. The government can't come out and just do another CARES Act, because they're going to exacerbate inflation. And if they do that, then the politicians aren't going to get elected. So what do they do? They can't support the markets because it creates more inflation, but they can't defeat inflation because that crashes the markets. So that's kind of what I see is the black swan event for 2022. And so it's predicated on consumer price inflation headline numbers continuing to increase. But I don't know if I'd call that a black swan, because I think that's on a lot of people's radar. But maybe it's just on people's radar that are kind of in this space. And outside of that, maybe it's on no one's radar. So maybe it still could be considered a black swan type thing. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think is going to happen when AI and autonomous vehicles take off, as both of these are extremely deflationary. Let's walk through that. What exactly do you buy daily that would go down in price and continue to go down in price. I'm not talking about just a one-time, bam, it goes down in price, but continues to go down in price as a result of autonomous vehicles. Just what? You say, well, we won't need truckers anymore, so you don't have to pay them. Okay. But once you get rid of the truckers, what makes prices go down even further? I'm not sure. And maybe you can have the trucks drive themselves 24 hours instead of just having to drive like 8-hour shifts. Okay, I get it. But how is that going to reduce the cost of, the energy prices? If we still have this ESG movement, no capital goes into oil, how is AI going to lower the price of oil? I guess I could see how it might lower the price of food to a certain degree, because you've got the transport and whatnot, but I don't see that making a huge difference, especially when or if the government continues to print $5 trillion a year to support markets. It's very tough for me to get to this deflation without the stock market crashing, without the without a complete collapse, or without omitting the Fed and government spending. I don't know how you get to without omitting the government and the Fed, I don't know how you get to a long-term deflationary environment in prices. I mean, I get that if you have sound money. But, look, this assumes that there has been no technological advancement since 1913. Have we not advanced technologically? So why haven't we had deflation since 1913? I mean, it's pretty much with the exception of the Depression. And let's not forget, even in the 1930s, we had inflation. It's a complete misnomer to think that all throughout the 30s, we just had prices going down and down and down and down. No, that's not what happened. They went down the first couple of years, but then they started to go back up. So I don't see that happening. I think that's, sure, you're going to have prices go down and things like TVs and electronics, but they have since I've been alive, they've always gone down in price, and we still had massive consumer price inflation. So, I think on the margin, that makes a difference, but I don't think it makes a huge difference when you're dealing with the cross currents of additional dollars in the system chasing goods and services and the reduction of goods and services. I mean, let's just do another thought experiment here. Say the government locks everyone in a cage for the next 5 years. Okay, how are we going to get to this AI and deflation then, right? So there's no goods and services being produced at all. There's nothing happening. It's just a stalemate. You say, well, George, that's probably not going to happen. Okay, well, I mean, it happened in 2020. And my point is even further that it's not just locking people in a cage, but it's also regulation. You know, if you have the cure for high prices are high prices in the sense that you're going to have more capital investment. But if you put up barriers to entrepreneurs creating more goods and services, then there's going to be continually higher prices. Now, you can say, okay, well, AI is going to be a cross current there that's going to have an effect of bringing prices down. Again, I get it, just like electronics have brought prices down as well, but we've still had consumer price inflation since the 1970s. And, look at cars. That's another great example. You know, the cost of cars is much higher, even when you adjust for inflation. Why? Because they come out with more regulations and more regulations and more regulations and more regulations that make the cars more and more and more and more expensive, even though they should be getting far, far cheaper when you look at just advances in technology. So, you know, I get it with the AI and the autonomous vehicles, but I think it's one deflationary pressure that could easily be overwhelmed by a tidal wave of money printing and a tsunami of government regulations restricting supply and creating those. I mean, let's think about it this way. Say you've got autonomous trucks. So yes, you have the deflationary pressure. Fantastic. I would argue it's a one-time thing and that the prices aren't going to continually deflate and deflate and deflate because you replace all the truck drivers. But just setting that aside, okay, so you say, well, food prices go down. Okay, but what if there's no food? So let's just, for a moment, say that that the only food in the United States is one loaf of bread. Just let's take it to an extreme so we can understand the example. So one loaf of bread. Well, you could have that bread, that one loaf of bread, delivered by an autonomous truck for free. Fantastic. Does that mean that one loaf of bread is going to go down in price? Absolutely not. That's the last piece of food in the United States. That bread is going to be, what's the price of the bread going to be? $100 billion, but yet delivered for free by a robot. You see what I'm saying? So, again, just to reiterate here, yes, that is a deflationary pressure, but I think it pales in comparison to the inflationary pressure of what money printing would do, or the inflationary pressure of what further restricting supply and mucking up these supply chains through all these economic distortions created by the government. Another thought experiment would be, okay, let's just say you've got AI, say you've got all these autonomous vehicles, and you give every single person $1 billion. Does that mean we're going to have deflation because of robots? Of course not. You're going to have massive price inflation. So, there you go. It doesn't mean that there's not going to be additional deflationary pressures. But it just means that there are a lot of cross currents, and we got to consider all the cross currents involved.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What groups have been adversely affected the most by the fiat money policies? I think men have been hurt the most. Peter Schiff says we used to be a country of rugged individuals. Yeah, I think the poor and middle class. That's it, because you just can't. You got to go further out the risk curve to get a return. Usually, the poor and middle class are going to be less skilled at doing that, and therefore they're going to get in at the wrong times. They're going to lose everything. I mean, the GFC is a great example of that. .com was a great example of that. Let me just go back throughout history. Usually every single bubble we have, when it crashes, it's just when it sucks in all the retail investors, the unsophisticated investors, because they get emotional, and then they lose everything. And so why do we get into these boom bust cycles where you're sucking in the retail investor, because for the most part, and we'd still have them. Don't get me wrong. Even if we had sound money, you know, if we had an environment like we had in the late 1800s, where you could get a 7% real return just by putting your money in a savings account, you'd still have booms and busts. You'd still have bubbles. And we still had the tulip bubble. We still had, you know, countless other bubbles throughout history. So you're going to have those, but you're just going to have a lot less of them. And the overall standard of living for the average Joe and Jane is going to increase substantially if you're in an environment with healthy deflation. And the way you can determine whether it's healthy or not is just ask yourself, is it going to increase demand or is it going to decrease demand? So once you get into an environment like we are in the United States right now, where you have all of this debt, if you had price deflation, that would lower demand because everything is based on debt and everything is based on asset prices. So if you have that, you're going to have that deflation spiral that the Keynesians always talk about. But if you have a solid, healthy free market, you have free market capitalism, you have sound money, then you're going to have a deflation because entrepreneurs are out there trying, like Jeff Booth says, they're trying to create products at lower and lower prices. And they're doing so to take market share because they're pursuing their own self-interest. And this is going to benefit the consumer. And usually what you see happen in those types of environments are nominal wages actually go up. They do not go down. So think about that. Nominal wages going up, but the price of stuff going down. What's that going to do to demand? It's going to increase demand. So, and that's a good thing for the poor and middle class. And it increases, nothing increases their standard of living faster than healthy deflation. And that's sustainable. You know, that is the world that we would have. And Jeff Booth is right on the money there. If we had sound money, problem there, or if we had free market capitalism, the problem is we have neither. George Gammon in 2024. No. There's just no way. There's no way. I can't, you know, you have to be very good at lying. You have to have no principles. Usually, I mean, Ron Paul is the exception, obviously. And, who's going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live, just FYI. So get your tickets right now, rebelcapitalistlive.com. But nah, I mean, he's an exception and he couldn't do it. I mean, look at Trump. I mean, the guy just lies through his teeth. You can like him or hate him or whatever, but even if you like him, I mean, come on. You got to admit he's just a blowhard, for heaven's sakes. He's just, that's what my dad used to call people like that. And, you know, he's just, he's going to just say whatever he needs to say to get reelected. And that's what all the politicians are going to do that. And that's not my style. So I think it'd be a big waste of time. And I think actually I can affect more positive change just by doing what I'm doing. I mean, I'm just now in the process of getting ready to go back to Medellin. Most likely here. We'll see. Hopefully I should be able to get in because although they have a mandate, and you guys know the mandate I'm talking about, to get in the country, that's only for people who are not citizens. And so, although I'm not a citizen, I have an investment visa. And since I have a visa, I have a cedula. And with that cedula, I'm treated as a citizen. So that mandate would not apply, hopefully won't apply. That's my team down there has done a ton of research on it. And that's the conclusion that they've come to. So why am I going down there? I'm going down there to hire more editors. And I'm going to create more editors. So not only, you know, I'm not going to be creating more content because it's physically impossible to create as, for most people, I think it's physically impossible to create as much content as I do. When you consider the George Gammon channel and the Rebel Capitalist channel, you know, on the Rebel Capitalist channel, sometimes we'll do 5, 6, 7 videos a day. And then the George Gammon channel, you're doing a whiteboard video a week, couple interviews, doing live streams. I mean, that's it's just an immense amount of content every single week. So I can't really increase my workload. But what I can do is set up a back end for people who create great content around the freedom and liberty and free market capitalism message. So Kiyosaki is an example. I had a conversation with the gal that does his editing, and she really needs help. If she had some good help, then they'd be able to crank out a lot more content than they do. And so that's the one advantage that I have, is I understand the editing. I understand the back end. I understand how all this stuff works on YouTube. And I have access to all of this, these incredible people and this incredible talent pool in Medellin because of the network I have there. And because of the people that already work for me, all my friends down there. And also because I did the TV show back in 2019 prior to starting the YouTube channel. So I've got all these things and all this experience that has helped me grow the George Gammon channel and the Rebel Capitalist channel. But I want to go down there and hire more editors so I can help other people grow that are just as good, or in a lot of cases, probably better content creators than I am. So people like Schiff or Dr. Chris Martinson or Kiyosaki or, you know, a lot of other people, just set up a back end for them down there. So they can leverage those same type of editors that I have. So, you know, they can do more content, and they can take the content they have and edit it and turn it into bits and pieces for TikTok and for Instagram and for Twitter and for all of their social media person to have and really leverage to grow their message and to grow their channels and to increase their exposure. Therefore, you increase their message. And if I can help people like Schiff and Dr. Martinson and Kiyosaki or Brett Weinstein or, you know, any of these amazing people, if I can help them increase their exposure, or if I can help them take their message and make sure it through social media platforms, help them take their message to a broader audience, then I think that's probably the best thing that I can do to move the needle in addition to what I'm doing with my own channels. So that's a far better use of my time, just as an example, than running for politics, at least in my opinion. So what are my thoughts on, excuse me, guys, this thing's popping up here. Okay. What are my thoughts on Dr. Malone and his medicine concerns? Well, I think it's a must listen for every single person. I listened to that podcast myself. And I think what's really telling about Mr. Malone and others that McCullough would be another example of that, that Rogan has spoken to in the recent weeks. When you contrast, so they've got a specific view, and you guys know the view I'm talking about. We'll keep it YouTube friendly here. And there's others that have other quote unquote experts that have a different view. Fair enough. I've tried to listen to a lot of the experts that have views that are that differ from Malone and McCullough as an example. And I've tried to listen to them on podcasts where not just they're talking for 10 or 15 minutes, but they're talking for an hour or 2 hours, 2.5 hours. I remember one. And I would challenge any of you to listen to some of those experts that have a different view, and then listen to Malone and listen to McCullough and see who you think has done more research. See, just ask yourself, who do you think has the best handle of the nuances in the data? Who do you think has done more research? Who do you think knows who do you think has dove into more of the studies? Just ask yourself those simple questions. And it's night and day difference, at least in my opinion. When I listen to people that have, experts that have different views from Malone and McCullough, they sound like amateurs. They really do. And no offense to those people. And I try to give them the benefit of the doubt, but they just scratch the surface level with their argument, I think, as far as the nitty-gritty and the nuance of the data. Where if you look at, if you listen to these individuals that Rogan has talked to lately, I mean, you want to talk about just, it's not just nuance. That's not doing it justice. But they go into such extensive detail and just nitpick every single little thing, even in their own beliefs and their own arguments. And it's just, like I said, it's night and day difference. So the person I'm usually going to trust is the person that I believe has given it the most thought and the most objective thought. And I don't think there's any question that the two individuals on Rogan's podcast have given it a lot more thought than individuals that are quote unquote experts that may have a different view. And honestly too, if you've been listening to what I've been saying on the Rebel Capitalist show, and I'm sure your own views, when you listen to what these guys are saying on Rogan, for me, it just is kind of common sense. I mean, obviously they come to common sense conclusions by going through their scientific process. But, just as an example, when they're talking about natural immunity, and I mean, if you would have asked me or any of you guys at the beginning of the Cerveza sickness, you know, what is the probability that once you get the Cerveza sickness, you have a reasonable, not obviously not 100% or whatever, especially with a new scariant, but a reasonable amount, what is the probability that you have a reasonable amount of immunity if you get the Cerveza sickness? I would assume that, and this was going back to, before we knew any of the data, I'm sure most of you on the live stream would have said, oh, there's probably a very good chance. I mean, it's just kind of, it's common sense, right? And now, of course, when you actually have the experts parse through the data, that's exactly what you find. And so I think a lot of the outcomes that we're seeing after 2 years dealing with this are pretty darn commonsensical. And, another thing, when you look at the risk reward for someone who's extremely healthy and someone who's had the Cerveza sickness, it's extremely healthy, say a 25-year-old male, it's 160 pounds, a cross-country runner, or something like that. And then you say, okay, well, if they get the medicine, there's probably, I think common sense would say they most likely have more downside with the medicine. And then once you get into but everyone is telling you the opposite of that. Everyone's saying the opposite. Well, they're actually not saying the opposite, though, because when the media uses that example, they never get into, they always just say, well, if they took the medicine, it would be better. Okay, but they don't go over the costs. They just go over the benefits, and they never say how much better. They just say, well, it's better. Oh, okay. Give me some absolute numbers. Just better. That doesn't mean anything. And then they completely ignore the fact that there could be any risk. They say, oh, well, it's safe. Well, what does that mean? I mean, safe for you might not be safe. What is that even? Is that 90%? Is that 100%? Is that 1%? I don't know what that means. So when you actually dig into that, like I did with that binomial calculator on the Rebel Capitalist channel the other day, you see that individual most likely has a higher risk of going to the hospital, as an example, if they were to get the medicine. So this is, and that's, again, something that if you just kind of think it through commonsensically, that's probably the conclusion that you would come to without even going into the data. And once you do, you see that, yeah, there it is. It's just right there. So I think that's what's most fascinating and encouraging from these conversations is that it just what they're saying, and obviously they're the experts, they've gone through the data, I think, more extensively than anyone else. And they're coming to those same conclusions that make a lot of sense, you know. And also, one thing that I found extremely encouraging from the discussion with Malone is how they started talking about social credit score. And it's great to see not just Rogan, but, you know, experts like Mr. Malone, who are cognizant of these things that we have been talking about since 2019, since I started the first YouTube channel. We've all been talking about this, and we've all been called tinfoil hatters and conspiracy theorists. And you guys know all the names that you're called by your friend and family member, Freds. But now it's great that this is not only getting out into the mainstream, but people who are extremely influential are cognizant of the things that we have been talking about for quite some time. And I find that very encouraging. They're also talking at the end of the conversation about how they're really pushing back against mandates. And, you know, the position that I've had since pretty much day one is that I'm not anti-medicine. I'm just extremely anti-mandate. And it's nice to see that there are other people that have the same view that are not only experts, but are incredibly influential. I mean, you guys know my opinion that at the end of the day, if you ain't got freedom, you got nothing. And that's my biggest concern. I think that's most of your biggest concerns going into 2022. So if we can win that war and get our freedoms back, you know, that's going to make all the difference in the world, not only for us, but for our kids and our grandkids. And to see people like these two individuals on the side of freedom, it's very encouraging, like I said, and it you know, gives me a lot of motivation to keep pushing, because it seems like we're making progress. If Republicans control the House of Representatives in November, will it really prevent a financial fiasco? No. The U.S. economy cannot be fixed by Republicans or Democrats or politicians. There is no way to fix that. The only way to fix the U.S. economy is to go through a recession, if not a depression, and get out all of the malinvestment and misallocation of resources. And that's going to, you're going to go through a time of a lot of pain and a lot of downside, and it gets very, very ugly. But that's the only way that you fix the problem. The only other thing you can do is just kick the can down the road and just make the problem bigger. Those are really your only two options. And it's just like a drug addict. The U.S. economy is addicted to a drug. And so you say, well, can Republicans make it any better for the drug addict? No, nor can Democrats. The only thing that's going to make it better for the drug addict is to get off the drugs. And if they do that, they're going to go through massive withdrawals. The only other option is just give them more drugs. But then all you're doing is just making them more unhealthy and kicking the can further down the road. So that's the best analogy that I can use.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capital's Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Similar lending rates on all stablecoins equals similar counterparty risk to Tether. I don't know, Seth. I'd have to see the balance sheet of the stablecoins. And I mean, as an example, if all the stablecoins were just backed by U.S. Treasuries, then no, they would have similar lending rates. Logically, they'd have similar lending rates. Maybe in practice, they might be slightly different here and there. Let's see, similar lending rates on all stable coins. Similar equals similar counterparty risk to Tether. I don't necessarily think that's true, because a lot of these stable coins, I mean, Tether as an example, is trading at 100 cents on the dollar. So, or 100 cents on the Tether, if you want to say it that way. But I think there's a significant amount of counterparty risk with their balance sheet. So, no, I think the market's just ignoring the balance sheets and therefore just treating them all as though they're a homogenous entity or they're some sort of monolith. But I do not think that is true. Even if the market is treating them that way, I think that's a mistake. Am I considering going off grid? What is your plan B at the moment? Well, no, I would not be very good off grid. I would be probably the worst person off grid in the history of the world. But I do like that RV. If I was going to stay in the U.S. here, if I wasn't going to Colombia, for I don't know how long I'm going to be there, for a week or a month or something, I would probably already have bought that RV that I talked about on a couple of live streams is maybe a month or so ago. It's like this bug out zombie apocalypse RV. It was really cool. It's called an HQ or Black something HQ 19. Wow, that's going to bother me. Black something. I can't remember. But anyway. That's probably what I'd get, because I'd like to go to a community. I'd like to find Plan B communities, but that doesn't necessarily, they're completely off grid. That would probably be my Plan B, but it doesn't mean that it's right for everybody. But I would not proactively go off grid unless I had to. And again, for people like Lynette Zhang, I mean, she's got her bug out property and she's great. I mean, she has all that experience. She has the skill set. She's got the team really in place to grow her own food and to create her own energy and electric. She's been doing this for like 10 years, probably more. So I have not. And although I've got a great team on creating content and whiteboard videos, not so much when it comes to growing our own food. I think it's a good idea and it's a great skill to have, but it's not a skill that that I've fine-tuned by any stretch of the imagination. So that's the best thing for me, is to have that RV when it hits the fan, if it does, just have that mobility to go, and then have an extra passport, you know, have bank accounts, have assets in other countries. That's kind of, I think, the best way that I can do it. And then if it hits the fan, then take the RV, then go somewhere that may be more permanent to kind of wait it out for a year or two, and then maybe buy a property or something. But I'm not saying that's right for everybody, but that's kind of how I've set things up for myself. And then I've got those diesel trucks as well to pull the RV. And I'll probably get that RV set up when I get back in the States. Oh, and then as far as financially too, you know, Bitcoin and gold, I think physical gold really play into that. Do I think Series 1 savings bonds? I'm not sure what those are, Troy. I don't really get into the weeds on the specific investments. I'm just pretty much strictly a macro guy. But I don't like any bonds over a 1 to 2 year period. I mean, you're just, no, I don't. I mean, if the only bonds I like is just super short-term T-bills, because you can roll them over and you've got the liquidity. I mean, if you grab a 2 year bond and interest rates go to, what, 7-8%, I mean, and you have to sell, you need liquidity, you're going to take a haircut. You become a forced seller, a motivated seller, and you never want to be a motivated seller. Where if you just got 3-month T-bills, an example, the longest you have to hold them is 3 months, and then you get your money right back. 100% of what you paid. Now, you could lose money in real terms, but at least you get the nominal value of what you paid back. If you have to hold something 2 years to get the nominal value back, but yet you have to sell it after a year, I mean, you're taking some risk. So I don't like that. And even if it's something that's tied to inflation, it's tied to the CPI, and that's a totally understated, bogus number. So no, I don't like any bonds. Unless it behaves in a different way that I don't know, because I'm not familiar with what a Series 1 savings bond is. Do I still think gold and silver relatively cheap? Relative to other asset classes, yes, for sure, for sure, for sure. As far as are they cheap relative to themselves, I don't know if it depends. I mean, if you're just going off a chart of their price adjusted for inflation, I don't know that they're super cheap, but if you are comparing them to the money supply, then I think there's an argument for them being cheap. I definitely think they're unloved. They're forgotten. They're unloved. And I like that. That's for sure. I think there could be an argument for the gold miners to be pretty cheap. And it's definitely something that's on my watch list. But I definitely think gold and silver are cheap relative to other asset classes, because their other asset classes are just in ginormous bubbles when you're talking about real estate, stocks, and bonds, assuming that those are the assets you're referring to. So I do not think gold and silver is in a massive bubble, and therefore, yeah, they would be cheap relative to those other assets, but I don't know that they're cheap relative to their own price going back decades when you adjust for inflation. Can you explain what Basel III this year is and how it affects the US, if it does at all? I don't think it really affects anything. The reason I'm actually going to go over this in a whiteboard video tomorrow, the reason I don't think Basel III really affects anything is because they've got so much off balance sheet stuff that I don't think they really have to report in Basel III. Maybe I'm wrong, but you know, if they're supposed to, I mean, would they? You've got the ghost ledger. You've got everything that goes on in the Eurodollar market kind of in the shadows. Again, that a lot of off-balance sheet stuff. So I don't think that Basel III to me is a lot like reserve requirements. That it kind of makes people feel good, but in practice, they don't make a difference at all. So even prior to March of 2020, and that's when they kind of got rid of the reserve requirements in the States, for some banks, they had a 10% reserve requirement. So everyone said, oh my gosh, well, thank goodness, because that means that banks can't just lend and lend and lend to infinity and create all these big bubbles. So that's something that constrains the banking system. But it doesn't. It doesn't. Because even if they didn't have the 10% reserve requirement, they just borrow it. They'd borrow the reserves. Just easy peasy. Listen, you got to ask yourself at any point in time, I mean, go back decades, and do you think there was ever a bank that thought, man, this is going to be a great loan? This is going to be an amazing loan. We're going to lend this group $100 million, and we are going to get an incredible return on our investment. This is the bank talking, right? And yes, you're approved for the loan. Great. We'll do the $100 million deal. This is going to be great for our shareholders, and it's going to make everyone a lot of money. And then they go back and they say, okay, guys, let's go ahead and deposit. We're doing a $100 million loan. Let's go ahead and deposit it in their account so they can get people paid and we can get this loan done. You know, get all the paperwork signed. And then you have some, you know, kind of nerdy kid that comes up that looks like a bean counter and says, excuse me, sir, unfortunately, we can't do that loan because we don't have any money to loan them. Said no banker ever. Maybe back in the gold standard. But no, absolutely. There's nothing constraining the banks whatsoever. If they think they can make money from this XYZ $100 million loan, they're going to create the dollars. And then they're just going to borrow whatever they need to borrow to make their balance sheet nice and pretty for reserve requirements. But now that we don't have reserve requirements, they're going to do whatever they need to do to make the balance sheet pretty for Basel III. And if that means that, you know, the assets they have to back up those liabilities that they created by creating the $100 million loan, if that means that those need to be off balance sheet, well, then they just need to be off balance sheet. I don't think there's anything that is really constraining the banking system whatsoever, other than the customer. So let me rephrase that. I don't think there are any regulations that are really constraining the banking system as far as creating more loans. If there's a demand for a loan and they think the person is, it's a good risk reward, the bank's going to lend. There's nothing. Basel III isn't, oh shoot, we would have made that $1 billion loan, but darn it, we can't because Basel III. It's just nonsense. But what offers, and I'll kind of give you guys a little bit of a preview of tomorrow's whiteboard video. What does give them a constraint is the people's ability to withdraw cash. And it's not that much of a constraint, to be honest with you. But that's the only thing that they cannot create. Because, see, they can create dollar-denominated liabilities. They can create dollar-denominated assets. That's a loan. A loan is a dollar-denominated asset. They can extend credit to one another on the ghost ledger. That's all denominated in dollars. They can, and when I was talking about liabilities, they can create a loan, and that's creating dollar-denominated liabilities. They can create all the electronic dollars they want. There's no restriction on that. But what they can't create are paper dollars. See, so if you go down there and say, I want my $100 million in paper bills, they can't figure that one out on the ghost ledger. that doesn't work. What constrains them even in better, obviously, is when you have base money as something that they cannot control at all, which would be gold. That would be gold, or that would be Bitcoin. So if you had one of those two things as a base money, then that constrains the banking system. Basel III or reserve requirements or blah, 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 blah. That, in my opinion, and I think Snyder would pretty much back me up on this one, that doesn't really matter at all. The only constraint is the ability for the customers to redeem their IOUs for something that the banks cannot control, create, or destroy. All right, guys, we'll go ahead and do some shout outs here. Again, we want to wish everyone a very happy new year. And remember, if you're late to the live stream, Rebel Capitalist Live is this Friday. Starts here in 4 or 5 days. So you got to get your tickets ASAP. Meet us there in Houston. It's going to be absolutely incredible. Go to rebelcapitalistlive.com to check out all of the speakers and to get your tickets. And I'm looking forward to seeing all of you here in just a couple days, Friday, at the cocktail party and at the registration. And it's going to be an amazing event for sure. Now let's do some shout outs. We got All Nighter Hider. I saw him in the house. Good to see you, buddy. Who else we have here? We've got Brian Bradley, Lisa Lyons, FNS, Dang Quang Trong. Not sure. I'm probably mispronouncing that. I'm sorry. Jonathan Boisvert. I think I might have got that one right. Eagle. We've got Revert to Means, RR, Brosie, Alex Smith, Jerry Faircloth, Legacies, Damien Alzowi, Retired Trader, R-E-3-I-R-T-H, Free Patriot, Mitchell, Brandon Smith, The Celestial Sphere, Average Jane, Veteran Prepper, Dave Scott, Benjamin Yabuga, and Anna Nguyen. I know I got that right because I've had some friends with that last name. Ken Long, Lori Stevens, Unknown Albertan, Quantitative Disease, Wayne Smith, Rolf Steiner, Adam Abdel Fattah, Zach Scheidler, and Market Mania Canada, my good buddy. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll see you at Rebel Capitalist Live and on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.